morning, I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. World Bank has just released its most recent Malaysia Economic Monitor report, with this edition having a special focus on expanding Malaysia's digital frontier. Now, to delve into the report, joining me on the show today from the World Bank is Dr. Apurva Sanghi. He is the lead economist for Malaysia. Apurva, welcome to the show. Very good of you to join me. And, reading the Malaysia Economic Monitor, every edition that's released, almost everyone looks at the projections for Malaysia's economic growth. World Bank is projecting 4% growth for this year. Put that into context for us, Apurva. Taking into account the recent economic developments, the global headwinds, everyone talks about the very sharp slowdown that's expected for the global economy this coming year. Put that into context for us, please.
So thank you, Melissa. It's great to be here. And before I delve into the predictions, I'd like to congratulate you on being voted as one of the change makers
in your
business. So it's lovely.
Thank you.
So on projections, so you're right, we are projecting 4% for this year, but that number has to be put in context. So first of all, what happened last year? So this 4% growth is coming off a base of relatively high base of around 8% last year. So that's good, right? And if you look at what's happening in the rest of the world, what are we projecting? We are projecting the global economy to grow at 1.7%. That's less than half of what we were projecting just 6 months ago. Advanced economies, just 0.5, 0.6% growth. So in that context, Malaysia does relatively well, as does the region in general. So the 4% is rather good. Now, I should say that what drives this 4% or what drove the close to 8% growth last year, we don't know exactly what it will be. The GDP numbers for the fourth quarter will come out on Friday, so we'll know exactly, but around 8% would be my guess. So two things. So Malaysia's export of commodities and non-commodities, and strong domestic private consumption. So these are the two things that drove growth last year. But of course, this year, because of external headwinds, we project growth to slow down to 4%.
Okay. All right. So I think that puts it into context. We have to look at the previous years for us to really understand what does the 4% mean. I think a lot of people look at just the headline number without understanding it in historical context, in a global context as well. But if we were to take a broader perspective, Apurva, when you look at the Malaysian economy as a whole, what should be the top priorities for either economic reform or economic opportunity, mm-hmm. Beyond just focusing on the headline figure, as the economy as a whole?
Right. So I've been in Malaysia, Melissa, now for just over a year. And what impresses me about Malaysia is how it went from being an plantation agriculture-based economy to being pretty much an upper middle income country, right? In a span of a few decades. And it did so by opening up, by investing heavily in education, by maintaining macro stability. But as we all know, Malaysia has ambitions, rightly so, to become a high income country. Yet it's stuck in this high income, in this upper middle income country sort of trap for almost 30 years. So according to our thresholds, Malaysia reached upper middle income country status in 1992. Fast forward, today is 2023. So clearly something needs to happen. And so where do we see the new opportunities or the new sort of potential for growth? Now, there are a lot of reforms that have been talked about, and
right.
People keep talking about education, health, so I won't go into those, but let me just sort of take a broader perspective. And I would like to just mention the three S's. And they stand for subnational, number one, number two, services, and number three, sustainability. Now, what do I mean by subnational? Subnational is states. So Malaysia has 13 states, 3 federal territories. It wants to be high income. But guess how many states are currently above the high income threshold? Only 3, right?
But so not even half.
Not even half.
Wow.
So how can a country become high income on the back of just 3 states? Mm. And even if it did, don't you think people will ask a question in the states that are left behind? How come my country is poor? How come my country is rich, but I'm poor? I live in a poor state, right? So there's a lot of unexplored, untapped opportunities at the subnational level. The second is services. What's happened, again, taking a broader perspective, what's happened over the decades is Malaysia's manufacturing base has been sort of shrinking gradually. Services have been growing. Services are about half of the economy now, but most of them are domesticated services. And in fact, trade in services is one area where Malaysia sort of lacks. And this is the focus of our MEM, as you mentioned, in particular digital services. Right? So there's a lot of room and potential there as well. And by the way, one area where Malaysia really stands out, I should also mention the positives in terms of services, is Islamic finance. Right? So Malaysia has about 2% of the world's Muslim population, but 20% of the Islamic finance global assets. So that is, you know, one really great area where it's doing a good job. And then finally, on the third, sustainability. Now, sustainability means different things to different people. For me, it means both fiscal and environmental, and the two are linked, by the way. We can talk about it. Mm-hmm. But without either of these, you know, Malaysia cannot become high income.
All right.
Or
okay.
If it did, then it wouldn't last.
I like that you encapsulated it in three S's, but I want to come back to subnational, looking at states. It struck me when you said, how can Malaysia become a high income country if only three of our states are high income? What should be done, or what areas need to be tackled so that we reduce this inequality among states? Are there things that need to be course corrected or recalibrated so that states are not left behind? Some states are not left so far behind compared to others.
Yeah, so that's a very difficult question to answer, admittedly. But let me just state some facts here. So one is that if you look at the data, so if you look at, for example, data between 2011 and 2021, so about 10 years. So Kuala Lumpur grew at 64-65% cumulatively, expanded by 64-65%. Labuan grew at 80-85%. Perlis, 18%, 1-8. Kelantan just barely over 40%. So if policies that the government had in the past did lead to some sort of equity among states, you wouldn't see this wide disparity in growth rates. There would be growth convergence, but what we see is growth divergence. So it's about growth at subnational levels, and that has a lot to do with, you know, the way the federal-state relationships work. But I would suspect that giving some more autonomy to states at some point to develop their own economy would be a good thing. We see that in various other federations. Next door in Indonesia, making the budget process more transparent than right. It is in terms of federal, state, you know, how the funds get allocated, that would help.
Okay.
So, but it's a tall order.
It is, definitely. But I'm glad that you pointed it out, because, again, an opportunity for growth for Malaysia. With the third S of sustainability, as you mentioned, you talked about fiscal sustainability as one of your ways to interpret that. That's sustainable angle. When I think of fiscal sustainability, I think of prudent fiscal policy, and that would also include subsidy rationalization, one thing that the World Bank has long been advocating for. Where are we, do you think, in terms of the progress that's been made? I mean, we talk about it all the time, the need for subsidy rationalization, but we often overlook the we often get stumped by the difficulties, but we also don't focus a lot on some of the unintended consequences that subsidy has had on our economy.
So I'm glad you asked that question, Melissa, especially in the unintended consequences. So I think in broad terms, the sense I get is that the dialogue on subsidy reform, everyone is aware of the need to reform for fiscal reasons. You know, fiscal pressures, absolutely. Most people know that the subsidy benefits are not enjoyed by those the subsidies are intended for. They are typically enjoyed, many of them, by the top whatever percent you want to say. Mm. So we know that you need to reform subsidies for fiscal reasons, for regressive reasons. But what most people, I think, may not be as aware of is that subsidies, first of all, crowd out expenditure on things that Malaysians really seem to want. And COVID has enlightened us all about the need to invest more in healthcare.
Right.
So just to give you one statistic, you know, so the last year, Malaysia spent 2.4% of GDP on fuel subsidies alone, and the entire MOH, Ministry of Health's budget, was just 1.9% of GDP. Right? So making this argument that it's not only about fiscal pressures, it's not only about the morality or equity of the rich benefiting from subsidies when they don't need to, let's also keep in mind there are other reasons. So one is a very practical reason, it crowds out development expenditures, and there are two other reasons. So if you look at rice subsidies, right? So subsidies and most of the ag budget, agriculture budget goes towards supporting rice.
Mm.
And there are historical reasons for that. But Malaysians are spending much more on other things now. They spend twice as much on fresh fruits and vegetables, I think three times more on bread and cereals, yet rice continues to be subsidized. So put yourself in the shoes of a farmer, right? So if you're getting these subsidies, if you can't, what really incentives you have to change your production style and to respond to the needs of to what Malaysians are spending most on? Mm. So subsidies distort the picture. So that's what I wanted to say.
Okay, those are the unintended consequences. We're going to take a very quick break, but let's come back and talk about why it's been so difficult for Malaysia to implement targeted subsidies. So we're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We will be back with more. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. We're talking today to World Bank's lead economist for Malaysia, Dr. Apurva Sanghi. We're discussing the recently released Malaysia Economic Monitor report. Just before the break, we're talking about subsidies, and we all know the need to rationalize subsidies. But when we think about how difficult it's been to have to make sure that the move towards targeted subsidies, there's progress towards that, and putting plans to phase out blanket, broad-based subsidies. Why has it been so difficult? Do you think those challenges are insurmountable?
No, I do not think the challenges are insurmountable because other countries have done it. So India has the sort of world's record of phasing out the world's most extensive set of LPG subsidies. And it did so fairly recently, 8-10 years back. And there are other Egypt, Indonesia to some extent with some hiccups, and Malaysia itself in the past, it did take a crack at subsidy rationalization, but it didn't stick. Now, so we've thought a lot about this question.
Mm.
And why don't we see a move towards, say, for example, targeted cash transfers happening? And I have some sympathy with policymakers on this. So one is, they are concerned that doing so could lead to inflation. So if you reduce fuel subsidies, it could have a knock-on as the price of petrol or fuel goes up, and that could have knock-on effects on inflation. So in the Malaysia Economic Monitor this time around, we actually did some analysis and found that if you suddenly removed all fuel subsidies in Malaysia, inflation would indeed go up by 9%. Right? So it confirms the concern that policymakers have.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it. And I'll tell you why. Because commodity prices have been coming down over the last few months. There's a window of opportunity and a political honeymoon that this government has in many ways. So if not now, then when? So make use of this window of opportunity. And nobody's saying that you should reduce the subsidies immediately. You can gradually phase them out. At least phase them out for the T20. I think there's no case for the T20 to benefit from this.
Can we talk about the timing then? I mean, I understand where you're coming from with the honeymoon period. There is pain. We need the pain before things can get better. It might get worse before it gets better. But given that much of the world is suffering from a cost of living crisis, Malaysia included. How do we balance that timing for the need for targeted cash transfers, subsidy rationalization, yet being considerate of the fact that many people are struggling, many people you wouldn't think are struggling, are struggling?
Yes, so in terms of timing, I touched upon this window of opportunity, right? So and another way of thinking about is if you wait too long, this window for opportunity will close. A political honeymoon period will be over, and who knows about commodity prices, where they'll be in the future. So in some ways, all else being equal, which it never is, but all else being equal, this is a case for subsidy rationalization sooner than later, gradually phase them out. In terms of cost of living, so I think there's a narrative here to be made as well.
Mm.
So it's not, as I said, it's not, when it comes to subsidy rationalization, it's not just about, again, reducing fiscal pressures as important as it is. It's about how doing so can help build Malaysia to be stronger and more secure. Now, we alluded earlier to the hidden costs of subsidies or the discretionary costs. Malaysia wants to attain a net zero goal fairly soon. But if you cannot do it if you have fuel subsidies in place.
Right. So you make fuel cheap, people will just
make fuel cheap. I mean, fuel is already cheap. It's cheaper here in Malaysia than in Saudi Arabia, for crying out loud. Right? So it already is cheap. I hope it doesn't get even cheaper.
Wow, I didn't know that. Yeah. Cheaper here than in Saudi Arabia.
I believe so, yeah. Wow. This is what I've been reading. So my point, if you do not reduce fuel subsidies, you're undermining your own net zero ambition. You know, it's like putting one foot on the brake in a car and on the accelerator at the same time. That car is not going to move much.
Okay.
So that's another reason in terms of the timing as well, in terms of the narrative that needs to be firmed up. You know, why subsidy reform?
Mm.
Yeah.
It also is one way for the government to expand fiscal space.
Absolutely.
Which is already...
That is well established.
Established, right?
Yeah.
So when we think about the government's need to expand fiscal space, has the government been looking at the right areas to expand?
So let's talk about fiscal space. Let's talk about the fiscal deficit.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not get too technical.
Okay. Let's talk also about revenue collection for Malaysia. We need to expand, yet we're not doing as much as we could in terms of revenue collection.
Yeah.
What would the World Bank's what would be the World Bank's policy recommendation?
So before I get into that, I think one important message I would like to give to your viewers, and it was a surprise to me as well when we started doing this analysis, that Malaysia has moved over the last 10, 12 years, has moved from a medium revenue, medium spending equilibrium to a low revenue, low spending equilibrium. And so you cannot focus just on spending alone, or spending on spending rationalization, for example. You need to raise revenues. Why? Because the health needs just by themselves require Malaysia to spend more, right? So how do you go back from this low spending and low revenue equilibrium back to a high revenue or medium revenue and medium expenditure equilibrium? And it has to be on both sides of the coin. So expenditure cuts, subsidy rationalization is very justifiable. As I mentioned, it will make a direct impact on the bottom line, on the deficit. But revenue mobilization is where the action is, or where the action needs to be.
Mm.
So the fact that revenues have declined by almost 30% from 10, 12 years back, and as have expenditures. Again, both of them have moved downwards, right? Both of them have declined by about 30-odd%. So you need to raise revenues. And there are various ways of doing it.
Right.
One is go ahead.
I was going to interject there and ask, there are various ways of doing that, but when we think of the needs, we always think of the immediate needs.
Mm-hmm.
What would be some of the low-hanging fruit that Malaysia can implement, particularly if you think about, you know, budget 2023 that's going to be tabled soon? Are there are there policy recommendations from the World Bank that might allow for some fiscal prudence in the budget?
So our general set of recommendations is that there is a need to have a proper medium-term revenue strategy on the revenue side, and that involves a mixture of instruments from GST to the personal income tax to sin taxes to carbon taxes. Said all of them have pros and cons. But thinking through how all these gel together and what difference would they make on the revenue mobilization side, and then thinking of implementation, right, implementing these. So that's one set of recommendations. On the expenditure side, we already discussed about subsidy rationalization. That is sort of the key thing you can do. You can do other things too, but that is the key thing. And just stepping back, and I'll stop here after this, is interesting that how over the years, over the last 20 odd years, Malaysia has moved towards being a consumption-driven economy. So consumption to GDP used to be about 40 odd percent in the late 90s. Now it's 60 odd percent, just over 60%. Mm-hmm. And this has come at the cost of investment. So if you look at this ugly sounding acronym GCFCs, gross fixed capital formation, economists are never good at coming up with great acronyms, GFCF, you and I can remember it. This is a proxy for investment. Now that has fallen down from its peak of over 40%, 20 odd years back, to below 20% today. So our recommendation would be Malaysia needs to do what it needs to do to get more investments. And it's not just foreign investment, it's also domestic investment. So its investment as a share of GDP has been declining, and a lot can be done in that space.
I do want to take the last few minutes that we have left, Apurva, given that you have so much experience working in other countries. You've seen economies grow, economies contract. When you look at Malaysia, are there things about the economy that gives you reason to be optimistic, that there are opportunities, should we not squander them, for us to improve, to become the so desired high income country that we want to become?
Yeah, so we spoke about some potentially squanderable opportunities that I hope will not be squandered, right? But just stepping back, and as a relative newcomer to Malaysia, I've been here for a year plus, I think Malaysian institutions are quite amazing. In the sense, if you look at the judiciary, what it has done over the last year I've been here at least, if you look at the central bank and its independence, right? If you look at the media, what you're part of, Melissa, right? So these institutions give me at least a lot of hope and optimism for Malaysia, because without institutions, everything else is secondary. Yeah. You can always complain about no institution is perfect. You can always find faults in each of these, but by and large, these institutions have held up. Yeah. And I don't know if you're aware or not, The Economist magazine came out with this recent democracy rankings, and Malaysia is ahead of India and under the US. And I lived in both countries, and I feel perfectly at home, right in between in Malaysia. So I think Malaysians ought to be proud of that, and they need to be optimistic about that.
Another very quick follow-up question, just from a global perspective. I'm curious to know, on the show, we use the phrase build back better. Mm. We've used it quite a lot over the past couple of years. But from the perspective of the World Bank, are you seeing that our countries, governments, economies building back better? Or have we forgotten the pain that we went through in the past couple of years?
Well, I think there are definitely green shoots if you want to look for them. One big green shoot, and pun intended, is a move towards climate, mm-hmm. climate action. And given geopolitical events, that really has expedited the move. So let me step back and give you my three C's in the context of that question. So where does Malaysia's future lie? Mm. Or what are some of the things that Malaysia needs to keep its eye on? So one is conflict, and by that I mean geopolitical conflict. There's a lot happening in the world. The world's a very volatile place. So how Malaysia manages geopolitical conflict, and so far from what I can tell, I'm not an expert, it seems to be doing well. But for us economists, the realization has been how integral geopolitics has become in terms of a core driver of the economy. Right? So that's, we don't have the luxury of just Oh, yeah, well, we consider geopolitics.
Okay.
You know? So the war in Ukraine, US-China tensions. So that's the first big C, conflict. Second is climate, and I hope I get a chance to come back and talk about it. And third is a metaphor for something broader, but let's call it cybersecurity,
okay.
A cyber whatever.
Mm.
But it's a metaphor for digital.
Mm.
Right? So we are in an unprecedented era of digitalization. Looking at green shoots, that's one. The pandemic has exacerbated both the bad things, but also some good things. And the move towards digitalization is one of them.
Right.
Right? So these are the three C's that Malaysia needs to keep its eyes on.
Apurva, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you, Melissa. Pleasure.
That was my conversation with Dr. Apurva Sanghi from the World Bank. We're wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.